Larry, let's get started with what has happened to Scott Ritter. What's your understanding on what has happened to him and how he has been treated?
Well, they're continuing they being the United States government, and in particular, in this case, the FBI. But I suspect behind the FBI is the Department of Justice, and behind the Department of Justice is some ethereal character back there in the Blinken, Sullivan, Biden, Harris world. Because Scott, of all the people who are talking contra U.S. policy with regard to Ukraine, Gaza, indeed with regard to the entire U.S. empire, Scott's probably one of the most effective, and he's got the bona fides, he's got the credentials, plus he's a Marine. Marines are never former Marines. They're always Marines for life. And that presents a problem for them. He's done a couple of things that I would not have done, as I understand it. Because he's a journalist, a bona fide journalist, he's taken money for some of the things he's done. That I don't know that for a fact, but I understand that is the case. And I think in one interview, he actually admitted that, whether it was TASS or Russia Today or whoever. But those kinds of things click a signal somewhere and give them not reasonable suspicion. They don't even have that. But they do give them something they can put down on a piece of paper and say, oh, let's go raid his house and get all his papers and see if he is some kind of foreign agent. I have no doubt in my mind that he's not a foreign agent, but he's hurt them. And he continues to hurt them. And so they're trying to intimidate him. I've got news for him. Marines don't intimidate. They're going to have to go after it. Well, same thing they did with Julian Assange, but with a real vengeance with regard to Assange. And now we see, sadly enough, that he had to plea bargain to get out of it. He shouldn't have had to do a thing because he was a journalist doing his job. But look what they did to him over the period of years that they had him in exile and in prison, Bel Marsh. That's the weight of the empire upon your back. You don't have to be guilty.
Yeah. Larry, in your opinion, right now with the conflict in the Middle East, where are we going? It seems that there are growing tensions within the Netanyahu administration between him and his party and his Ministry of Defense. What's going on, in your opinion?
I think there's a lot of tension there right now. I think the temporary bump up in the polls that he got was both a reflection of staggering percentage I saw yesterday, but it was a pretty reliable poll, I think. 47% of Israeli Jews support everything Netanyahu, Smotrich, and Ben-Gvir are doing. That's a real comment on a sadist state, in my view. That said, he's got problems. He got a little tick in the polls from his visit to the United States, as he always does, one of the reasons he comes. But there is dissension. There's dissension amongst the extreme right, the Smotrich, Ben-Gvir, and others like them. There's dissension with Yoav Gallant. There's dissension with the IDF leadership in spades. And there's also dissension, I understand now, over what is coming, because many feel that Netanyahu is responsible for what is coming. And let me just interject a little aside here. This morning, a man for whom I have some respect, Harlan Ullman, who used to be a professor at the National Defense University and was one of Colin Powell's confidants, Harlan and Colin used to talk quite a lot, suggested in a piece he wrote that just came out that we don't know, nor has Israel admitted, who killed Ismail Haniyeh. And he posited several different possibilities, everything ranging from those in Hamas who are not necessarily happy with the way he was going with negotiations. I don't think the insinuation was Yahya Sinwar, the new leader, but the insinuation was there were elements. And then there was the insinuation that the Hezbollah people don't particularly care for him either. And then there was insinuation that there are some people in the IRGC and all manner of different things could be. And the fact that Israel hasn't come out and claimed it, I think it doesn't necessarily say it wasn't Israel, because remember the Stuxnet virus that we in Israel put in Iran's nuclear computers and messed up their centrifuges. We didn't admit that for a long time. And I'm not sure either one of us has officially admitted that. Israelis are pretty good about doing things and then not having to boast about it. When they want to boast, they boast. But when they don't want to, they just let it linger and lie there and don't take claim for it. But if he did do it, then there are people within the administration who know he did it and probably aren't happy about it, because it took away that side of even the extreme right that might have wanted to do some kind of a hostage exchange deal and maybe even wanted a ceasefire, because in that ceasefire period, Israel would have some respite too, particularly the IDF. And so if he did it and they know he did it, then they're angry at him for doing that too. And if he did it and they know he did it, they're angry at him because of what might come. Because I think Iran has decided it was Israel, and they are going to strike back. And this is not going to be a small strike. And it may be coordinated with Hezbollah. Indeed, it may be coordinated with Hezbollah, with the Houthis in Yemen, with militias in Syria, and with militias in Iraq. It could come from all manners of sectors and vectors. So they're not happy about that. So Mr. Netanyahu is probably in some dicey water right now with his own people.
Larry, when they're talking about maybe Hezbollah, and the question is, why does Hezbollah need to kill Ismail Haniyeh in Iran? That doesn't make sense in Iran. Kill him in some other country.
As I was reading Harlan's possibilities, I was discounting them one after the other. And, you know, my inclination is to think that Israel did it, because he makes some good points in his piece. Why did they do it that way? And why did they do it in such a glaringly obfuscating of the peace process way? Does Netanyahu really want a war so badly with Iran that he's willing to risk everything on the throw of a dice? This could be the throw of the dice. That's some pretty serious thinking on Harlan's part. I'm a little uncomfortable after reading his piece. I still think the world is more or less right that Israel probably did it. And I think that Netanyahu was behind it. And I think his purpose was, as I've said before, it was to kill all prospect of a ceasefire and a peace process until he's finished killing everybody he can in Gaza. And it was to take out the individual who sort of presented a face to the world of Hamas that was not cruel, brutal, and terrible like Yahya Sinwar does. By the way, I watched a really excellent piece on him last night, video piece with narrative. Brilliant guy who was himself, I believe he was a lifelong resident of Khan Yunis. And he talked at length about his period in prison, which of course was most of his adult life before he got out. And he talked about how he learned Hebrew, one of the few who has and can speak Hebrew. And he learned it for a reason, because he wanted to be able to talk in the enemy's language, which is really smart. So this is a very different kind of Hamas leader. And of course, he can't do the kind of things that Haniyeh could do, because he can't move around freely. He's number one on the hit list, I'm sure. And so he has to stay in the tunnel complex or somewhere like that within Gaza. I'm not sure, given what this man said about him and his character, he wants to get out. He wants to be there and he wants to lead this this effort by Hamas to teach the occupier that there's a price to pay for the kind of concentration camp the occupier created in Gaza. But it is a change, and it's going to be interesting to see how Netanyahu deals with that change. I'm sure they're out galloping, trying to figure out exactly where he is and assassinate him, kill him. But it is a change, and these changes have all perturbated the situation to the point where I'm not exactly sure what the dynamics are anymore, except I do believe there is a building effort to coordinate a fairly substantial strike against the state of Israel. which is going to bring Israel to its knees and bring the United States in. To what extent the United States comes in? Is it just the carrier strike group that Austin just ordered to go at flank speed for the Eastern Mediterranean because they weren't there? I don't understand the submarine. The submarine, what are we going to do? Chase Israel's submarine around and maybe keep it from shooting its missiles? I understand it has capacity to shoot ballistic missiles with nuclear warheads on them. So I hope we do have a tag on Israel's submarine or submarines. And I say that for a reason. June 8th, 1967, a brutal attack on a U.S. intelligence ship in international waters in the Mediterranean. And Israel went at it again and again and again with torpedo boats and with aircraft. I think there were French Rafales. They killed 31 Americans and they wounded about 170 Americans. They even machine gunned people who were in the water. And we covered it up. We essentially covered it up. We had our usual commission and all this other stuff. Israel paid about $13, $14 million in three installments over the years between. The last installment was for repairs, if you will, on the intelligence ship. But what's that? We give them $3 billion a year and they give us $13 million back for reparations. They went to the families of the killed and then the families of the wounded. But that's Israel. That's our ally. So that they would do what people are saying was probably them, kill Hania and then set this up and then essentially set it up so that it would bring Hezbollah in, bring Iran in a big way, and bring the United States in to finally do what Bibi Netanyahu has wanted us to do for all of his prime ministership. And that is take on Iran and take out their nuclear program. That's the most likely scenario. And if that's coming about, I agree with Alistair Crook. I heard him this morning on the judge's show, essentially saying all bets are off then. Then we probably have a wider regional war. And I don't just mean Hezbollah, Syria, Iraq, United States, and Israel. I mean a wider war, maybe even with Turkey, maybe even with Russia. We already have Putin, I would call now the man of indirection. He was diverted a little bit by what Zelensky did around Kursk, but that was a political show. That's all that was. You know, there are people in Ukraine who even have taken Zelensky on because they say it was a waste because the real problem is in the Donbas. And you took away from the Donbas to do this. Meanwhile, your 20-year-olds, your 19-year-olds in the Donbas are surrendering, getting captured or killed as fast as the Russians can do it. So this was stupid. And it was. It was stupid. It was an attempt to get the headlines again in a positive way. But it was really stupid. But Putin is moving on multiple sectors now. I call it the strategy of indirection. B.H. Liddellhart wrote about it. He is going after other places. I understand that right now our 900 or so remaining troops in Syria are virtually surrounded. They can't move. They've been pushed out of the oil fields, which was their original purpose, was to guard that oil pumping to Israel. Well, if that's the case, that's a big detriment to Israel, too. The only thing they really have left is the people who are still selling to them. And I understand the biggest is Kurdistan. Out of the Kirkuk or one of the oil fields in the northern part of Iraq. So the situation is getting deeper and deeper every day. And I think Alistair's right that we may be headed for a pretty substantial conflict in that region. And that's not good at all. It's not good at all. Russia's coming at us through Syria. Russia's coming at us through Yemen. Russia's coming at us through Iran proper. I can just imagine the big Russian aircraft that are landing and offloading all the sophisticated air defense capability, particularly, but perhaps other things too. Maybe even some more ballistic missiles, which can't be shot down, as Alistair was saying today. You know, when they shoot those drones or they fly those drones and they shoot those missiles and everything, there'll be some ballistic missiles in there, maybe even some hypersonic ones, and they can't be shot down. So they're going to hit Israel wherever they're aimed. And that's another point. Where are they aiming? Are they aiming at Tel Aviv? Are they going to kill bunches and bunches of civilians? I'll tell you what will happen if they do. Israelis will unass their country. And the airports won't be capable of handling. Netanyahu will have to shut the airports down and refuse to let them go. What are they going to do when he does that? We've seen protests of hundreds of thousands before. So, yes, to answer your question, Israel's in turmoil. Israel is in desperate straits in many, many ways. And Israel is exemplifying and proving that what I said, that it would not be a state in the Levant, has a real possibility of coming true.
And Larry, how do you find the position of Russia right now? It seems that they're trying to bring some sort of sanity. They're trying to talk with Iranians. And on the other hand, we know that how close are Iran and Russia right now. And the other thing is there are rumors that there are some negotiations between Iran and the United States. Do you see that possibility behind the scene?
Oh, yes. I imagine they started immediately after confirmation that Haniyeh was dead. And I got to imagine that Bill Burns is at the head of them and that Qatar and Oman are facilitating. And it might have been a little bit difficult to break in initially, but the Iranians don't want war either. Not with the United States. They don't want war with us. They've proven that. The April events prove that. That was orchestrated like a play on Broadway. And it was orchestrated because Iran and the United States agreed, as did all the other participants. So that we're talking again is, I think, just self-evident to me. We're trying to make sure that what Iran does, if it does anything, we'd prefer they not do anything, but if they do something, we'd prefer that it's manageable. And here's the kind of comment. I wrote this down this morning. This is Britain, France, and Germany. This is their official statement. Quote, Iran and its proxies will bear responsibility for actions that jeopardize the opportunity for peace and stability in the Middle East. End of quote. Well, think about that for a moment. Who said that about the assassination of Haniyeh? Who said that to the other side? You know, no one. And certainly not France, Britain, and Germany. Certainly not Britain, nor the United States. That's pure Orwellian doublespeak, and it just typifies the idiocy of how, first of all, how our press and European press is covering the situation, and how if it is in the least bit not just pure propaganda, if people actually believe this way, how insane we are. The rest of the world sees Gaza for what Gaza is, a genocide being perpetrated by that little upstart state, and it is an upstart state. Most states are older than it, if not all of them. And it's in the name of what? Greater Zionism? It's in the name of people who want to kill other people to take their land away from them. It's in the name of people who couldn't even occupy those people for the years and years they've occupied them under Geneva. This is crazy. Why are we doing this? Who sanctioned this? The UN Secretary General this morning, Guterres, pretty stern words flowing out of his mouth for a change. And I think the rest of the world sees this not only with some fright and some fear, because they see the possibility for spinning out of control and maybe even some of them dragging them into it in one way or another, but they also see it from a perspective of the insanity. And here's the kicker. I don't think anyone in Washington sees it from the perspective of they're in an asylum looking out. They don't. They think this is all copacetic. This is all what Lindsey Graham said, in an effort to consolidate the riches of Ukraine for the West rather than for the East. I mean, there's some truth in Lindsey Graham saying that. He believes it, I'm sure. And he covets those riches for us rather than for other people. I'm sorry, that's not the way the world's supposed to work, though. I know you work that way, Lindsey, but that's not the way the international system's supposed to work. And, oh, by the way, who designed the international system, Lindsey? Come on, give me a break. But there are some people who are very worried about what might happen in the Levant, and put at the top of the list, Washington, because as I said, at the end of the day, they do not want a war with Iran.
And here comes the question, if they don't want, and Iran doesn't want a war with the United States as well, how they can bring some sort of sanity to the government in Israel, because they have to put some sort of pressure on them. The way that they're attacking civilians right now, it's unbelievable. There has to be some limits to these actions. That's and true. These growing tensions, Larry, within the Netanyahu administration shows that there are many differences within the government. They are most radical. I don't know how they thinking, what's the main reason of this difference. But at the end of the day, the government in the United States, the Biden administration, can just take this opportunity to put some sort of pressure on them.
Well, you've hit the key issue. And that's what's really troubling, I think, much of the rest of the world. Why does the United States tolerate such action from the tiny little enclave at the eastern end of the Mediterranean? Why? Put the Holocaust aside, put everything else aside that might be explanatory in the past of what you might call somewhat biased behavior. Today, that makes no sense. That makes no sense because this isn't biased behavior. This is insane behavior. This is selling them 2,000-pound bombs, 500-pound bombs, 250-pound bombs, 55-millimeter artillery rounds to kill people, innocent people, to kill innocent people with. And every time Israel bombs another school or another refugee center or another hospital, whatever, and says that Hamas was there, the rest of the world shrugs their shoulders and said they're lying sacks of proverbial horse dung. And they are. They are. I take you back to 2003, 2004, whenever it was, when the Corys came to see me about Rachel, their daughter. And I know the Israeli government. I know it intimately. I was lied to. I was stiffed. I was told to go blow it out my rear end. They did not do any kind of reasonable investigation into the death of Rachel Corey. They killed her. They murdered her. Just as sure as I'm sitting here talking to you. And well, this is it writ large. This is murdering whole lots of people. And look at the Western press. I looked at two this morning. One said 32,000, another said 40,000. Yesterday, I read 50,000. Come on, people. There are probably 200,000 Gazans dead right now. What is all this crap in the mainstream media about trying to limit as much as they possibly can the atrocities performed by Israel? Well, I know what it is. They're paid off, too, just like our Congress, our media is paid off by AIPAC. They are in AIPAC's hands. They are in the sway of AIPAC. But this really doesn't help the situation that now has the potential to spiral out of control because it takes all the emphasis off the White House. It takes all the pressure off the White House to do something substantial to rein its little puppet in the eastern end of the Mediterranean in. And I probably used puppet wrong. We're the puppet. And Netanyahu's the puppet master, as he proved when he spoke to our Congress and called all those useful idiots. Oh, no, he wasn't speaking to them. He was talking about people like me who were protesting outside the Capitol while he was there. But the useful idiots were sitting in front of him in the Congress.
But you've been paid by Iranians.
Oh, yes. I got my check right here. Let me show you. I got a check. It comes from the National Bank of Iran. It says, we'll be paid when we have some money.
It's unbelievable, Larry.
And watch out now. They'll be at my door next. You know, they've come to me twice already before Scott. Once they came to me with regard to Cuba when I was working for President Obama, sort of on the side, diplomatic track two diplomacy. And once they came to me on Iran when I had the gall to go down and give a talk on U.S.-Iran relations for Medea Benjamin. And so because I associated with Medea, they came to my door. That was a very nasty visit, too. I essentially wound up throwing them out.
Larry, do you think that this attack, this raid on Scott's house is coming from his position on Israel or on Ukraine?
Both. both, and his, shall we say, consorting with the enemy. I'm surprised they haven't come after Ray McGovern, because Ray, I think, went to that same soiree in Moscow a few years ago that Scott went to. But Scott's made more trips, I think, than Ray to the Soviet Union, now Russia. And Scott has probably a lot more contacts over there, and therefore a lot more conduits into real information about what's happening in Ukraine and what's happening in Russia in general. And so they don't like that. They don't like that at all. And he was consorting with the enemy. You know, that's what Lindsey Graham would say. Look at what they've done to Tulsi Gabbard. I mean, I think Tulsi's kind of lost a little bit of it since she left the Congress, and I thought she was one of the sanest members there. I'll tell you this. I went to brief her on the U.S.-Iran Accord, you know, what we came to call the JCPOA, the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. I went to brief her on it. I just briefed about six or seven other members of the Congress. I went into her office, and I started to brief her with my team, and she started talking to me. And before she finished 15 minutes, I looked at her and I said, "Congresswoman, I don't need to talk to you." She knew more about it than my team did. So I had a lot of respect for Tulsi. And I don't know. She got some, she sort of, you know, trip to Syria and other things she did. But Tulsi basically is a pretty smart woman. But that's what they do to you. When you show any kind of, Hillary Clinton, I'm sure, went into her office one day and said, "That woman's got to go," you know, about Tulsi Gabbard. Something about, "We came, we saw, and she died." That's just the kind of person Hillary Clinton was and is. And I took out some emails the other day and I was reading them. These are when Powell and I were in a private capacity together. And Powell was talking to me about Hillary, and he was talking to me about Madeleine Albright. Oh, ho, ho. You wouldn't want to see those words above the poll front page of the Washington Post. Some really hard warmongering women. That's what I'll call them. Remember Madeleine talking about the 500,000 kids in Iraq that had died because of our sanctions? And she said she thought it was worth it.
Larry, in your opinion, if Iran decides to negotiate instead of attacking Israel, what would be the best position for Gaza to negotiate on the part of Iran?
Well, it's complicated now tremendously by the way I understand the negotiations have to take place now. They don't have anyone like Haniyeh, and they have Yahya Sinwar. I don't know how you do that. Because I wouldn't go to any negotiations if I were he. So how do we get together now? I'm sure that was part of Netanyahu's, let's say that we believe Israel did it. That was probably the primary reason that he did it, because this guy was able to move around, able to conduct talks, had the trust of the Qataris, the trust of the Saudis, the trust of others. Even I would say probably indirectly the trust of the United States. So take him out. Let's put someone in there who's nothing but a former prisoner, volatile dude. I don't care if he speaks Hebrew. He's a mean man. He's tough. We got to get him because he's the leader. He's the guy who planned the whole October 7th event. You know, that's an allegation also. I don't know where we go from here. Because do we have another side to negotiate with that has the capacity to negotiate in earnest and for real?
The other thing, Larry, was this, the Israeli media showing that they're raping prisoners in Israel. In your opinion, why would they do that? Just putting out and saying that this is legitimate. We have to make it legitimate for this type of torture.
There is an element in Israel now, and this has given them full voice, that thinks it can do anything it damn well pleases. That's the clear fact. And they are corroborated in that by the fact that the United States doesn't say anything substantial, and even more so, doesn't do anything substantial to rebuke them. So you give them an inch, they take a mile. And instead of saying we'll investigate this, which is their usual ploy, that's what they did with Corey, with Rachel Corey. We'll investigate this. We'll do it at the IDF. We'll do it at the Adjutant General. We'll do it within the foreign ministry. We'll investigate this. We'll come back. You know, well, it was all bull. They didn't do anything except come back and say, oh, it was an accident. Sorry. That's gone now. There's not even that circumspection. There's not even that hesitation. There's an element in Israel that says, middle finger to you. We know you're with us. We know we can't do anything, no matter how egregious. You remember Donald Trump saying he'd go in Times Square and shoot someone and no one would punish him? Well, that's the way they feel. And so it's all out now. Why should we hide it? Why should we hide it? This is what we should be doing to these animals. That's the way they feel.
Larry, in your opinion, it seems that we are getting to the point that the government, the Biden administration, has to tell Netanyahu and his administration that look at what's going on with the Houthis, and looks what's going on. Look at Ukraine right now, the situation in Ukraine, and right now you're getting attacked by Iran and all these countries around you. How long we can come here? How long we can be in that region helping you? Because it's not sustainable for the United States to stay there. And they have to show Israel that it's not possible. And they have to learn how to live, how to understand the situation they're in right now. Do you think, is there any effort on the part of the Biden administration just letting them know that the reality of what's going on?
I think there are some people, and I would put at the head of the list, the one who's probably at the head of the negotiations for a ceasefire and a peace agreement, Bill Burns. But I think there are some people who are delivering some sort of forceful message to Israel. But back to Putin for a moment, you look at what he's doing, this strategy of indirection, it's all around this region. I think Putin is becoming the major supplier of the Houthis. I think Putin is probably going to work on other militias in the region. I just did an interview for the Middle East Broadcasting Network, State Department's group, and we talked about the recent attack on the U.S. forces in Iraq. And the bottom line of my remarks was, get them out. Sudani, the prime minister of Iraq, does not want them there. The parliament does not want them there. Get them out and they won't be attacked. Well, why do you think they're there? Well, Blinken talked about the comprehensive agreement and all the security agreement and everything. We've got to fight ISIS. ISIS, Iraq can handle ISIS now. We're there because we don't want to leave with the potential for what might happen in the next 6-7 weeks. We don't want to leave because we got a foothold in Iraq, and Iraq is next door to Iran. So we want to be there, at least in an introductory way, so that if we have to do something that requires land forces, we're already there. Same, I think, to a certain extent with our residual force in Syria. Although that's becoming very imperiled right now, and Putin is seeing to it being very imperiled. So he's playing all these little matches, if you will, around. Plus, he's talking to Turkey. He's talking to China. He's talking to other people in the world who increasingly, Modi in India, for example, who are increasingly disenchanted with us, who see the opportunity to break away from much of the constraints and restraints that we've put on them over the years, and to do a better deal, if you will, with the other side being China and Russia and the BRICS and all the rest of the things that are lining up. This is a volte face in the world. This is a change that has been coming for some time, but it is really being accentuated by these two conflicts in their own different ways. And the change is the money and wealth is moving away from the West. And Lindsey Graham is right to a certain extent when he talks about, oh, we need Ukraine bad. We're willing to kill all the Ukrainians to keep it. Because there is a very visible movement now in the world of the money moving away from the West and into the East, a sort of a switcheroo on the way the world started out in the first place, with most of the money and enterprise, trade routes and everything being in the East. It's going back to the East. And China, of course, is like a magnet sucking it back to the East. Now, there's an interesting thing going on right now that I'm watching really closely. The Russians and the Iranians and the Chinese are behind this, but so are the Turks and so are others, smaller nations. In fact, almost all the stands are behind this. We did it in 39 and 40 with the British when we saw World War II coming and Germany getting out of hand. They're rebuilding, reestablishing the line from the southern part of the Persian Gulf up along the Gulf, Alexander's route, and all the way up through Azerbaijan and into the Soviet Union and into the Central Asian complex. That is what they did 1,000 or so years ago in order to, as I recall, the Portuguese were giving them the biggest problem because they were shipping everything by water. Think about the Red Sea and the Suez Canal. And the rates were lower because by water, you didn't have to pay all the taxes you would have to pay to all the intermediaries if you had a land route. Well, they finally fixed that by going around and negotiating the Persian Empire, the Roman Empire in the West and the East. They negotiated these contracts where the taxes would not be so high. And interestingly, they were just a little bit lower than the cost of shipping with the Portuguese bottoms. So that route suddenly became the real route for trade. And it was a land route. Well, that's what Russia, China, and others are doing right now. They're carefully doing that. We did that in the late 30s and throughout the World War II so we could ship stuff to the Soviet Union. We actually put almost as much tonnage up that route into the belly of the Soviet Union through Azerbaijan as we did through Murmansk, with a lot less problem because Murmansk was, you know, real problem with the ice sometimes and the cold weather. That route's going to be energized again. And you look at the rail that China is building or has built. They've reduced the time to ship goods from China to the heart of Europe to 16 hours by rail. That's about one-tenth what it takes to do it out of the ports of China and around through one of these other ways like the Suez Canal, the Red Sea, whatever. The world's changing. It's changing. And that's one reason why we're sticking our insane fingers into the heart of Europe, Ukraine, and other things we're doing right now, because we are so we're wild about this change. You know, when Obama said we're going to shift our focus to the Pacific, he was basing it on studies that were done in the Pentagon and elsewhere that said this was going to happen. Well, it has been happening for about 25 years. It's happening big time right now. We're expediting it with our insanity and stupidity, and Putin is taking advantage of it as much as he possibly can. And of course, China is the magnet. So this is all taking place, and we can't do anything about it, except if we had good leadership. If we had good leadership, we'd recognize it for what it is. We'd recognize the power shift. We'd recognize that there are multiple polars in the poles of power in the world today that are fixing around this shift, building new transportation routes, building new pipelines and such. And we become a part of it. Now, BlackRock, bet your butt BlackRock is there. BlackRock will finance the Chinese, the Tajiks, they'll finance anybody in there who's there. If you've seen any of the capitals in Central Asia and the things they're building now, the hotels in Dushanbe cost more than the hotels in Los Angeles. It's incredible what they're doing. And we're just basically ignoring it, or worse, we're making insane decisions to do things like we're doing in Ukraine and to a certain extent in the Middle East too, in order to try and hold it back. And it is not going to be held back. It's like somebody standing up in the middle of the Mediterranean on a raft and saying, I want you to hold back all the empires while I fix Rome. Mm-mm, ain't going to happen. It is not going to happen. The best you can do is try to accommodate it and make as much money out of the trade and the economy and other things that are happening as you accommodate it. But you ain't the hegemon anymore. You might not ever have been the hegemon, but you certainly are not now. But we're desperately trying to fight on the fringes of our empire to make sure that nothing happens untoward with regard to the stability and mostly money-making capability of that empire. Alistair Crook talked about it this morning on Judge Napolitano's show in economic terms, and how much we're sitting on that is really collateral. How much the $120 trillion of global debt, and that's not counting the black world debt, nor is it counting commercial debt or personal debt, but that much debt is sitting on top of a collateral worth maybe $2 or $3 trillion. And that is the world's greatest Ponzi scheme. And it's going to all come crashing down, God knows when. But the people who are going to ride it out and survive are going to be the people in the East, not the people in the West, because they're riding the wave of the future. And we're desperate to keep that from happening. We're trying to arrest that wave. We're trying to beat that wave. We're trying to knock that wave down. That's impossible. You get on your surfboard, you get atop the wave, you catch the crest, you drop into the tunnel, and you surf with it. You don't fight it. It'll drown you.
Yeah. Larry, it seems that the Biden administration has decided to withdraw the troops from Iraq. And we know that Iraq is a hub to feed Syria. And Syria is in support, the troops in Syria in support of Israel. What does it mean for the future of the conflict, in your opinion?
I've heard no definitive word other than the prognostications of the administration that someday we will leave Iraq, that we're going to leave Iraq. And I think the prime minister in Iraq understands that too. And he's very frustrated by it. And this business of Iran maybe retaliating and the war widening and getting even deeper is going to keep us there. But to your question, I don't think that it would be injurious to the empire, such as it is now, to pull all of its forces on the ground out of the Middle East, because they are an invitation to problems. And we've known that for years. We've known that ever since 1978, 79, when Jimmy Carter declared the Persian Gulf a vital security interest of the United States. At the same time, the military said, nobody on the ground. Nobody on the ground. We had a strategy of offshore balancing. You know, marine amphibious units in the northern Oman Sea, around the Persian Gulf, carrier strike forces, we call them battle groups then, things like that. But never troops on the ground. And then all of a sudden, bin Laden sucked us in. And that was bin Laden. If you go back and read those late 90 fatwas, that was one of his desires, was to suck us in, put us on the ground, defile the holy places, be significantly in the region, and be therefore attackable and injurable and woundable and killable. And that's where we are now. And it's stupid. Our hard power is in Kuwait. It's in Bahrain, it's in the UAE, it's in Saudi Arabia, it's in Israel. This is crazy. We have no business being there. We're so vulnerable. Every trooper walks around with a red bullseye on his back. And this situation right now is going to make that even more intense. You know, if you read Ali Soufan, who's the one guy I trust on Al-Qaeda, he says that Al-Qaeda in Yemen is as powerful as Al-Qaeda anywhere has ever been before. And Yemen has given them an Afghanistan-like atmosphere and terrain on which to rebuild, train, recruit, and get ready for new operations. And they do have a global capability, just like the Al-Qaeda of old. I would dare say we're going to see some attacks in Europe and in the United States from this element of Al-Qaeda in Yemen, far more dangerous probably than any ISIS group. Even ISIS-K, which has managed to conduct a couple of pretty glaring terrorist attacks in Europe and in Russia. We're not paying much attention to that right now. We're just paying attention to the bigger scene, which is allowing that to happen. we need to pay attention. We need to pay attention to the whole thing, but we do not need to have troops on the ground in the region. We should pull all of our troops out of the region and go back to offshore balancing. One reason we may not do that, purely personnel reason. We don't have the people to man our ships. We do not have the platforms, and we do not have the people if we had the platforms. You know, Trump talking about going to 320 ships for the U.S. Navy was a laughing stock of the Navy, a joke. The Navy can't recruit for the 270 ships it has. How would it recruit for 320? And this is something that I believe the military leadership is completely falling down on. I don't believe they're telling the civilian leadership just what the shape of the U.S. Armed Forces is. They scream about wanting more money. They scream about to the Congress their unfunded priorities list. You know, this is what I need. I need $6 billion more. And Congress says, well, I'll give you $3 billion more. But they aren't looking at the heart of the U.S. Armed Forces, which is not beating very soundly, especially in the Army, especially in the reserve components, especially in the Coast Guard, whose vice commandant just came out and said something finally. And the only service that's recruiting to its numbers is the Marine Corps, and they have recruited their numbers because they dropped their numbers significantly. So they don't have as high a target to go towards. If we had to fight Iran, Nima, we'd get beaten.
Larry, when it comes to the conflict in Ukraine right now, do you understand what's the reason behind this attack on Kursk region, and what has the Zelensky administration achieved by this attack?
One thing they achieved, I understand, and this comes from a pretty reliable source, is a real fight amongst the military leadership and civilian leadership in Kyiv, because part of them, rightfully so, in my view, said, what in the world are you doing this for when the serious, serious fighting is in the Donbas, where the serious effort has to be? And you're off doing this down there where there's no real rhyme or reason to do it other than your publicity stunt? That is an argument that's going on in Kyiv right now. And I agree with that argument. I think this was a publicity stunt. And Putin will deal with it forthwith. It doesn't seem to have bothered him all that much. He will deal with it forthwith. As I said, his strategy now is one of indirection. I think Nima, and I don't blame him for thinking this way, and I have to say this, and people will, you know, the FBI will be at my door tomorrow when I say I admire Putin. I don't admire his character. I don't admire what he's done. I don't admire the invasion of Ukraine. What I admire is that he thinks. He has a head and a brain, and he uses it. And right now, what he's doing, I think, is he's making sure that if NATO is truly as insane, as deceitful, and as stupid as he has viewed it for the last 18, 20 months, he's ready to fight them. And he's ready to fight them from a position where he can win or at least achieve a stalemate without going nuclear. And so he's setting up his cards around the world now to make sure that that's the case, because he has every suspicion that NATO is not going to give up on him until they have brought him down personally and in terms of his country, bled it to death. He knows, I think, he's smart enough to know that with the strategic depth Russia has, lots of people have tried that. No one's achieved it. The one who came close might have been Vladimir Lenin, and it cost him his life and brought us Stalin. But I think he's getting ready for that. And I think he's going to bequeath that probably to his successor, he thinks. Maybe not. But he wants to be ready for that. He wants the defense industrial base to be capable. He wants his military to be capable. What better place to get battle hardened than Ukraine, as long as you don't cost yourself too much? And who cares if Zelensky wants to do showboat things every now and then? You'll clean them up and take care of them, which I assure you he will eventually. These are forests down there. And, you know, the only thing down there was border patrol. So it was pretty easy to do what they did. But I really think Putin is smart. I think he's looking to the future, and he really distrusts NATO and the United States in particular, and he's getting ready to fight us.
And just to wrap up this session, Larry, right now it seems that in Germany, the country that has suffered a lot, I would say the second country that has suffered in this conflict in Ukraine after Ukraine would be Germany. And they're trying to brag that German tanks are on Russian soil right now. What the hell are you talking about? What would be the gain for them?
None whatsoever. I'm told that Germany's economy right now is hurting so badly that when we get to the winter, if it's a really hard winter, they're going to have a hard time heating their homes. They're going to have a hard time doing anything other than just living. Won't be as bad as it was in 43 or 44, I'm sure, but it could be pretty bad. That's going to cause an eruption in Germany, a political eruption. Probably will happen, at least in part, with the elections coming up. I don't know what's going to be the result. It'll probably be something like France. It'll be modeled. You know, you look at it and you say, well, why won't Macron allow the party that got the most seats in the National Assembly to form some sort of government and govern? Well, he won't because he's a tyrant. And because, you know, we've seen these kind of French tyrants before. I think a similar political situation has a good chance of developing in Germany, where you have the old line, if you will, and you have the Alternative for Germany and maybe some other coalitions that get together in there. And you really have a difficult time ruling the country because you can't get a majority in any one of the major sectors like France. I don't know what that means other than I think it does not mean a healthy NATO. It means what I've said all along, that NATO is going to fall by the wayside. And then you've got to think about who comes after Harris. Who comes after Harris when Trump has made an absolute mockery of 50% of the political apparatus in the United States? And that's what he's done. He has made an abject mockery of the Republican Party. How will it recover? What's the situation with the Democrats when they come out of their, you know, 80-year-old Nancy Pelosi, Steny Hoyer, you know, Chuck Schumer idiocy and transition into some of these younger people whom we're seeing demonstrate across the country right now in terms of the future of the Democratic Party against things like Gaza? For things like the Inflation Reduction Act, which was supposed to take care of a lot of the needs of climate change and such. There are big changes coming here, too, if they're allowed to be made, if we don't have, you know, a real hiccup and a problem like we did in 1860 and we wind up in the streets fighting each other, which is a possibility. I don't discount that possibility. So the future is really mixed right now for the empire, I think. Tremendously mixed. If we don't find a glide slope to form our retreat down, to maintain ourselves as a pares inter pares, an equal among equals, if we don't stop trying to be supreme amongst all the rest, if we don't find an accommodation and ability to collaborate and cooperate, we're in trouble. We're in big trouble. We may dismember ourselves. We may fall apart internally. We may be sucked into some war that we lose dramatically. And that's a big concern of mine because I know we'll go nuclear if we do. One of my colleagues asked me the other day, do you think Israel will go nuclear? Well, the first thing I did was cite the Liberty and, you know, the cruelty of the attack on the Liberty in the Eastern Mediterranean. And I said, would Netanyahu, Smotrich, Ben-Gvir, and that crew go nuclear if they thought everything was going down? Yes. And then he asked me the follow-up question. Would they go nuclear just to go nuclear? And I said, what do you mean? And he said, would they do the destruction just to do the destruction before they go out? I said, that's an interesting question, but it's one I don't want to contemplate. Because right now, that regime that is ruling Israel right now, in the totality of it, even with the arguments and everything else, I think gave him that conception or that perception. And I'm not so sure he's not right. That's a horrible thought, but in their dying gasps, as it were, they might do that and take everybody else around that they can at the time. That's where we are with this state. That's where we are with this state. I think they've outdone Hitler. You say, oh, they don't have gas chambers. They don't have. They didn't have time to build the gas chambers. They are doing it with steel, and they're doing it with starvation, and they're doing it with disease. But they're doing it.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Larry, for being with us today. Great pleasure, as always.
Surely. Take care. Don't.